Good afternoon. So last time we talked a bit about what that commit stage did, sort of pointed out that we had cases where we would run a bunch of instructions and then realize, oh, wait a moment, didn't actually need to run these. And a way we could deal with this is by having this list of sort of all our instructions from in the order that we got them. And we check going through that list, starting at the top, and find if there was a place where we made a mistake and shouldn't continue on, usually because we had an exception or a branch misprediction. And we'd have some logic to reset our registers to the state boundary for that exception. And we learned later on that, oh, well, we're resetting our registers and probably anything that was like going to be stored to memory, but we don't reset everything. There's some state in our processor which generally we ends up still changing from these sort of speculatively executed instructions. And this state is not something we could observe directly. One way we could observe some state in our processor that's kind of not exposed directly is through timing. And in particular, and very interesting part, the processor is this cache where we have some things that are in the cache and some things that aren't. And we don't have instructions to like ask, is this address in the cache directly? Well, we can kind of figure out that indirectly. And one pattern for doing this was this idea called prime press probe, that we would do this prime step where we fill the cache or the interesting sets of the cache with some known data. Then we do run some code that is going to put things in the cache. And when it puts things in the cache, it's going to have some space in the cache to put that. And that's going to use certain sets of the cache, and those sets have a limited capacity. And in our prime step, we'll have filled those sets. So we'll see that stuff gets evicted, that some of the stuff we put in won't be there anymore when we check later on. And from this, we can infer exactly where in the cache was accessed. And often, some code runs that ends up choosing addresses we kind of aren't really supposed to know, where you know, we're going to learn a little about where the program is accessing something, and maybe that's not something we're supposed to have, but we'll get that information anyway. It's through this side channel, this kind of, we have an operation, hey, cache, what sets were accessed? We're kind of doing this in a very indirect way that the cache didn't design to let us do. It just happened by accident. And finally, we finished up talking about these meltdown inspector attacks, which are kind of the combination of the fact that our processors will run things speculatively, so we'll have branch mispredictions or exceptions, that even though there's an exception or branch misprediction, we'll still keep running stuff. And some of that stuff will produce side effects, like modifying the cache, that we can observe through these side channels. And kind of the pattern we saw is that the processor did some operation that wasn't supposed to happen speculatively, and ordinarily the results of that operation would be hidden from us, but we could expose the results by using that operation to, you know, modify the cache or some other side channel potentially. We only talked about how to do it with the cache, but it turns out if you have other kind of things that aren't cleared by the process of undoing a branch misprediction or handling an exception, those also are viable ways of getting this information out. But basically, we can kind of leak this information about this value that wasn't even supposed to be read, or some other, you know, secret information, in a way where you can retrieve it after the processor allegedly undoes this thing that wasn't, the speculatively executed thing, the thing that was never supposed to happen, that in our single cycle processor would never have actually run. So questions on things we covered last time? Yeah?
Can you go over again, what was the difference between meltdown and inspector?
What is the difference between meltdown and inspector? So meltdown was the, in meltdown, this the pattern here, this was the speculative thing part was the permissions check. Interesting. Oh, no. Okay, it does not go. Permissions check. in Spectre, the speculative part sort of was a sort of normal memory access. So at Meltdown, we were bypassing the page table permissions check because the processor somehow decided that checking the permissions was a separate step from actually retrieving the data. In Spectre, we were bypassing some check that would prevent us from doing, say, a memory access that's out of bounds, and we'd end up getting data from an out-of-bounds access anyways, because that would happen speculatively. Does that answer your question? Other questions? I see my handwriting with this setup is way worse than usual because I have smaller area than usual. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So, one note, so for pipeline grades, I posted some grades on Sunday, and initially the autograder didn't actually check the forwarding. I corrected that today. Sorry if your grades, if relatively small number of people's grades changed downwards, because the autograder basically just skipped the forwarding and just said, oh yeah, it's fine. You don't need to check it, because I made an error in seeing if there was something to look at. And then some notes on anonymous feedback. So one person saying, hey, I have some lecture questions, like the one where we talked about the 5-cycle multiply execution unit, which has some tricky questions. Is this something we should expect to be on the final exam? I'm generally more willing to ask tricky questions in lecture than exams, because like you have time to talk to people in lecture and the stakes are lower. Now, on exams, I try to write my questions, so I think they'll be interpreted reasonably, but I've been surprised about how they actually end up being interpreted. I've been getting better over the years, but things still happen, and we'll try to deal with this in grading when we discover that some people read the question very differently than we do. And on the exam, please write when you think a question has like two interpretations or missing info, because we're going to be grading it with people. We can look at that information and actually like figure out how to give you credit for that. But if you don't tell us and you think there's two interpretations, we're just going to assume otherwise. And then asking generally about about preparing for the exam. I always feel like my advice on that is very generic. The biggest thing I see students sometimes doing, well, the thing I recommend is doing things that are active, because the biggest thing I see students doing that seems ineffective is things that are passive, like let's watch all the lecture videos just on a screen and not taking notes or doing anything. That's probably, you want to try to do things that are more active for. As for timing of the exam, I hope the exam is not so long that time will be a big factor, given that we have a 3-hour slot. I usually target 40-ish, the equivalent of 40-ish multiple choice or short answer questions. Of course, my idea of if a question asks you to write a line of code, how many short answer questions that equivalent to might be different than yours. And it's 40-ish, so like 45, maybe less, but that's sort of roughly what I target, something which should comfortably fit in 3 hours, even though, yes, I know some people would take the full time if I give you 24 hours in person. Yes?
Will there anything be online on the submission site, or will it be online?
Question, what will the exam be online on the submission site? It will be in person, in this room. On paper. If that doesn't work for you, you should talk to me as soon as possible. Yes?
Should we expect to write a lot of C code, or just like
should we expect to write a lot of C code? We may have you write one or two lines of C code. We're not going to be picky about syntax for that, but yes. We're constrained in how much we can have you write by how difficult it is to grade the more code we have you write. But we may have you write, like, fill in the blank, some C code or something like that. Yes?
We're asked to, like, write some code using some function that maybe we use in lab that would be, like, provided with landing pages and stuff like that?
If you're asked to write code that needs some function we use in lab or some other, or you might want to refer to documentation, we'll be providing that documentation. I hope to either provide you all that documentation or allow you to make things up so it doesn't matter what the documentation says. Or provide you, like, maybe not the full documentation, but, like, here is the list of functions and the description of what they do, and your answer needs to be consistent with that. Yeah.
How many multiple choice
versus short answer? It will be, so I'd say equivalent to multiple choice short answer, so we might have some questions which are not of that form, either format, where I won't have you write probably more than a sentence, but I might have things where I have you write a brief explanation. And I don't know the get mix of questions yet. I have something written, but I haven't gone through my TAs to tell me my questions are bad, and, like, I'm prioritizing more that I and my TAs think it's a good set of questions than a particular mix of types of questions. Does that answer your question? But generally, fewer, like, I'm less tied to multiple choice and short answer than I am on the quizzes, because we'll have more grading bandwidth. But I don't expect answers that are, like, longer than a sentence, because I don't want to grade that. So that's not what I'm looking for. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, and then some other anonymous feedback, and I see I smartly LaTeX cut off the thing here, but there was some feedback, you know, re-specific TAs, which, yes, I have gotten, and I'm not gonna talk about specific TAs being bad or good in front of this lecture, especially not without conversation with them first. And then, can I post a list of the topics that are on the final? So when making the final, I went to the schedule page. So there's your list. That's how I made the final. So. So, like, obviously, I'm not gonna cover all the topics there, but that's what I looked at for making questions, as I looked at what did we cover this week, what did we cover this week? Can I have questions on that? And but our main topic for today is, as promised, exam review, which I'm going to switch to here and here and to here. So for exam review, as I said, I'm going to take your questions. So I will collect a set of questions and write them down, put them in some ordering, and then I will go through them. If we have time, I will collect more questions later on, but I'll just collect this set at the beginning and we'll see how long that takes. So what are things people would like me to talk about? Yes?
Can you talk about sort of how routers work in networking? Like what layer you would have the IP address of a router be the source or destination?
Oh, routers and networking. Different network protocols, like, can we be more specific?
Like DHCP, what's the uses of, like, DHCP, IP, DLF, just like a general definition.
Okay. Anything else? Yeah.
Processes and threads.
Like, what are they? Okay, yeah. I ask more specifics because often I feel like I'll go over the part you already know. You don't ask me more specifically. Yeah? Virtual versus physical addresses. Anything more specific about that? Or, okay, just generally, okay.
Cryptography,
you know, okay, when to use public v private keys. Okay. Anything else? Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Have you added to member 5? Basically, how does the kernel mode memory get mapped to physical address?
Mapping kernel memory to physical addresses. Okay. And back there? VM lookup. Okay. Anything else? Yeah. Okay, saving and restoring state in context switches.
Yeah. And like what the processor saves versus what the OS saves.
Okay. Anything else? Yeah. Pipes, okay. Sort of Spectre, what bits are exposed, or Spectre meltdown, sort of what bits are exposed through subchannel. Okay, yeah. Are we given a reference sheet? I will make a reference sheet. The exact contents will depend on what's on the exam. But
will we see that, like, before the exam at all?
I may post it before the exam. As I said, because the exact contents will vary, I can't give you, I guess I can show you what I have now, but it's like there might be things that are added to it or removed from it depending on what the exact questions are. Edit, yes, so the reference sheet I'm proposing is this one. Looks like this, where I want to add something on networking layers that I haven't put there yet, but page table lookup, cache, and processors. And yes, I'm going to add something on network layers, but I haven't decided what that is yet exactly, and that depends on what the questions on the exam are. I should talk about that, so. Put that at the top. So just covered. Other things I should talk about. Yeah. Exceptions v signals. Okay. Yeah. Forwarding and stalling. Okay. Anything else? Trying to make sure I'm not missing people. Yeah.
Overview of threads.
Threads? If you have something more specific, but yes. Okay. So mention the reference sheet. So there will be one. I will not finalize the contents yet. But sort of will have sort of diagram of cache organization and VM lookup and pipeline, at least, and may have other stuff. Okay, so going through topics. So processes and threads. So a process is kind of this virtual computer that your program runs in. And it has its own memory, which we can call its address space, you know, implemented typically via virtual memory. And it has its own cores, so threads, implemented by sort of context switching plus assigning to one or more real cores. So a thread, you know, usually we mean, when we're talking about threads, usually we're talking about multiple threads in a single process, and if so, they share sort of address space, and I guess I can talk about some other things in the process, its own sort of I/O devices, which are files. Address space and files. Since we need a call stack to run things, each thread has its own stack. And if there are multiple threads sharing memory, you know, sharing the address space, that stack, you know, each stack needs to have a different virtual address. And this means that, you know, so, and also implies that one thread can use a pointer to access things on another thread, things on another thread stack. So that's my overview of processes and threads. Questions on that? Yes.
Is context switching on a single core CPU kind of the same behavior as like a multi-core?
Oh, question. We'll get to that in context switching. Maybe make that clear. But on processes and threads, kind of more definitionally, we'll talk about context switching next for that specifically because it's on the list. So context switching. So if we have one core and want to run multiple threads on it, we can't load the thread, you know, the data, the values for each thread simultaneously. So need to have the threads take turns. So how do we do that? So we're going to take, so the OS, you know, so whoever's doing the context switch, which is typically the OS, so code that does the context switch needs to save sort of the register values, condition codes, program counter for old thread and restore them for the new thread. And if we're switching from one process to another, also we need to change the page table base register to change the address space. And we're only switching between threads in the same process. We don't change that because the memory you can access is the same. As for what does the CPU versus the OS do, so, you know, the OS can do all this in software, but when we run the OS from an exception, something needs to save, save what the program counter was before the OS started running, or else the OS won't know it. You know, so e.g., a timer, you know, a timer goes off the middle of a loop, you need to know where in the loop we stopped. So the processor's logic for exception handling is definitely going to save the previous PC, and then the OS will probably copy that somewhere if it does a context switch. Because that's the information it wants for later on, so it can go back to that code. The processor could also say, help the OS by saving additional stuff, you know, somewhere to make writing exception handlers more convenient, but this isn't sort of necessary for correctness. Yeah. Question, are context switches between threads or between context switch processes? So context switch can be between a thread from between two threads in one process or between two threads in different processes. And if they're between threads in different processes, we're going to have to do this additional saving, changing of information. Yes? Question, am I going to post this text file when I'm done? Yes. Other questions? Yeah.
Are context switches triggered by traps?
So the question is, what triggers context switches? So context switches triggered, context switch can be done by, the OS can do this all in software. Anytime it's running. So the OS if the OS gets to run, it can do a context switch if it wants to. So, but if we're switching, especially between two processes, we definitely need the OS to do that because we don't allow normal programs to do switch. So generally, if the OS runs, it can decide to context switch if it wants to. Usually sort of based on sort of policies about who gets to use the CPU. So there's some decision that the OS designer made about, oh, this program should run this often. Technically, and definitely need the OS's help to switch from one process to another because normal programs can't chain, user mode code can't change the page table base register. Technically, we didn't talk about it, but you can technically do a context switch between two threads in the same process entirely in user mode. That's not the sort of threads you've generally used, but it is a type that you might see in some sort of programs out there. It's not the type of threads pthread gives you, pthread create gives you. Okay, so then exceptions versus signals. So exceptions are a hardware feature that runs the OS, runs a handler in the OS for certain events, and the certain events sort of include sort of program doing something deliberately or accidentally, I/O devices doing things, timers, and probably some more I am forgetting. And signals are an OS feature that runs a handler in a program for certain events. And certain events can be program doing something, other program deliberately triggering a signal, some other things I'm probably forgetting. So the relationship is that, you know, these kind of provide similar types of functionality, but between different layers. So the exceptions are hardware for the OS, signals are the OS for programs. And so often, signals will be triggered by an exception, meaning the OS's exception handler will deal with the event by causing a signal. Question? Yes.
Where do interrupts fall into that?
Where do interrupts? So interrupts are, you know, types of exceptions. So interrupts, traps. So they're a type of exception. Does that answer your question? Yes.
Can you explain like
where the handler
is? Where is the handler?
Where is the handler located for which of these? For both. So in both cases, the handler is somewhere in memory. So in the case of the OS, the OS has a, you know, some memory. So the handler in some OS managed memory, usually at addresses marked only marked not accessible in user mode. Because we don't want programmers messing with the exception handlers. That's the OS stuff. It should always be handled by the OS code. And here, the handler is a normal function, you know, in the program. Loaded into memory the same way the other stuff in the program is loaded. Other questions? I guess I should emphasize, and the handler, something which maybe is a little subtle here, is that the exception handler sort of runs in the middle of whatever's happening. And here, the signal handler runs in the middle of one of the program's threads. So if a signal is triggered, it's not going to run sort of, so if I send a signal to another program, that signal handler runs in the other program's threads. So we have to switch to the other program first. So signal handler won't run until we switch to that, you know, switch to or are otherwise running that other program. Whereas the OS is exception handlers, the OS just gets to run in the middle of whatever's happening, no matter what that is. Other things on exception signals? Yeah.
Could you talk about how syscalls are involved?
How are syscalls involved in exceptions? They are a type of exception. And they fit into this deliberately part. Does that answer your question? Okay, so let's do next here. So pipes. So to talk about pipes, we should probably talk about files. So files, sort of on Unix-like systems, let us read and write. And sort of regular files, we read, read data stored somewhere, and or write data to store somewhere. And pipes are files where we get a pair of connected files, sort of the read end and write end, and we can read, I guess, I should emphasize files, let us read and or write. Because if we open a file for reading as open files, I'll put a pair of connected open files, we can write to the write end open file, then later on read from the read that data from the read end open file. And an application of this is that we can start a program with an open file that is a pipe, that is, for example, the write end of a pipe, then if we read from the read end open file for that pipe, we'll get whatever the program wrote. And that's what we did in one of our assignments. And sort of, since pipes are an open file, we can mostly use them interchangeably with open files that would represent a file on disk or a terminal, etc. They have the same interface to a first approximation. But obviously, some details will work differently. Like if you try to go to the beginning of a pipe, that doesn't really work, but you can do that with a file on disk, but you can't do that with a terminal. But they work similarly to that, so the program, most of the time you can give a program a pipe and it will just do its thing, and rather than going to a terminal, it will go to this other open file that has, that lets us read from it. Questions that on things I didn't cover about pipes people were confused about. Okay, so then about virtual memory stuff. So virtual versus physical addresses. So virtual addresses are the address. So when we have a page table base register loaded, page table active, sort of all the addresses we use in assembly. So anything, so this is the addresses we write from, sort of code addresses, data addresses, they're all virtual addresses. And physical addresses are the sort of real hardware addresses that the memory understands. Memory and cache understands. And produced from virtual addresses using page tables. You have a question?
Yeah, it was for pipe.
Okay.
If you try to write to a readend of the pipe, will the program crack the seg fault or will it just return a...
So the question is, what happens if you try to write to the readend of a pipe? Sort of writing to readend or reading from right end will return an error, like reading from a file open for writing, or vice versa. So the same interface as you're used to with if you open a file for writing and try to read from it, that's not going to work the same way. It's not going to work for a pipe. So then, back to virtual addresses. So virtual addresses are all the addresses we use, all the addresses we see, and they get translated to the real addresses on the machine, which are physical addresses, and those are the ones that the actual memory and caches are going to be using. And the mapping from virtual to physical addresses is chosen by the OS, because the OS chooses what's in the page table it tells the C processor about. Or I should say page table. So the question of how kernel memory works with this. So most OSs keep at least reserve some virtual addresses for OS use. And this is so they don't need to change page tables when running exception handlers. So you don't have to do this, and there's some one of the mitigations for Meltdown was basically avoiding this as much as possible, but generally they do this. But we can't allow programs to edit the OS's memory, so we'll mark them in the page table as not accessible in user mode. And the processor will enforce this by triggering an exception if user mode code, the lowly user code, tries to access them. Question? Yeah.
Isn't that still potential exploit for Meltdown?
So the question, isn't this a potential exploit for Meltdown? Yes. So avoiding this was a mitigation for Meltdown if you didn't have help from the hardware. So this was the big change that, so these days, hopefully newer processors fix Meltdown in a way where the hardware fixes it. But if you want to fix it in software, this is generally what was done, is having a completely different page table for running OS code. So it's invalid, but it's faster not to do that. Didn't have help. Other okay, and then splitting addresses into pieces for the virtual memory lookup. So we divide, all the possible virtual or physical addresses into fixed size pages, where the page size is a power of 2. This means that, if we take an address x, then x divided by 2 to the k is going to be equal to a page number, and this is going to be the same as the all but the lower k bits of x, because of how dividing by a power of 2 works. And x mod 2 to the k is going to be our page offset, which is going to be where on the page we are, because the first page starts at 0. So as we go more and more bytes, we get further in that page until we go into the next page, in which case we start back at 0. And this is going to be the lower k bits of x. So that's sort of the basic way we divide up an address. And question here? Where are the page tables actually stored? So they are stored in memory at some, and we have to specify where they are with physical addresses, because otherwise we have a chicken and egg problem. Does that answer your question?
Where are the physical addresses stored? How do we know what the physical addresses are for the page
table? How do we know what the physical addresses are for the page table? So page tables, using page tables, and the page table base register contains a physical address for finding the page tables. So the OS code that's setting up the page tables has to know the physical addresses. It has to know it anyways, because it has to put things in the page table that give physical addresses. So it can tell the OS where in physical addresses they are. Does that answer your question? So a question for the page table structure, we'll get to that when we talk about this, but yeah. What does K represent? Power of 2 is the power of 2 that the page sizes. 2 to the K bytes. Yes?
So
aside from, I guess, changing the base register, like what else is it achieving, like between processes?
Do we have to change something? We said going between processes, do we have to change something besides the base register? So not for virtual memory, that's enough. The OS, of course, needs to track what program is running to know, for example, what files it has the current process has open, but that's probably something that's some bookkeeping that's relatively easy to do, and we don't usually think of that as part of a context switch, but obviously the code's probably in the same place. Okay, so this is our basic division, that we divide up our addresses into, so we have our virtual addresses and our physical addresses divided up into a virtual page number and a page offset and a physical page number and a page offset. And these might be different lengths, so I'll draw them as different lengths to emphasize that. Now, sort of. So when looking up, so the page tables let us look up a virtual page number and get a physical page number plus some metadata. And most simply, we just use the virtual page number as an array index into a single page table. But this doesn't work when we have a lot of possible virtual page numbers. So instead, we use multi-level page tables. And we split up our virtual addresses into pieces. So in part one, we divide our virtual page number into a bunch of parts. Of some size that I've divided up unevenly here, and sort of divide the VPN into pieces, use the first piece as an array index for the first level page table, which will be pointed to by the page table base register. So this is kind of our master table. And then use the second piece as an array index for the second level page table, which will be pointed to by what we found from the first array lookup for the first level. And we repeat this process until we get to the end, and then use the result of the third array lookup to get the final physical page number and metadata. And this gives us a tree data structure, a fat tree data structure. That because we have a very high number of branches at each level of the tree. That tree data structure where we have one root, the first level table, many which branches to potentially many second levels, each of which branches to potentially many third levels, and so on. And we can save space by not storing second plus level entry table page tables that would be all invalid. And the reason this works is that we only do the second level lookup. We only get this far if first level marked as valid. We only get this far if second level, first level entry, sort of array out marked as valid. And the same thing if so we have this short circuiting, so we don't have to have the whole tree in memory. In fact, we almost certainly won't. We'll just have the pieces that have actually something interesting. And sort of the key way we use it is we go through the virtual address in these pieces, starting with the most significant bits. Yes?
When allocating extra physical pages within one process, would the OS try to use existing first, second, and third level page table?
So the question is, where, if we want to allocate additional pages, what page table entries do we modify? That's going to depend on what virtual address we want to put them at, because that determines exactly where we look. So if we want to give a particular virtual address, we don't have a choice about exactly where in the page tables the pointers for that are. Does that answer your question?
I mean, just like in general, like, would the OS try to like, not create additional... Like,
the question is, would the OS try to not create additional page tables? So usually this is not really a deliberate decision, but since when you ask for, like when you malloc memory, you expect to get like contiguous addresses, right? You don't expect me to give you, here have 200, 900, 25,000, and 30. You expect to get a range, and that will kind of just naturally have them take up less space in the page tables. Does that answer your question? Yes. Question, how do I calculate the size of the virtual address space? So the size of the virtual address space is the number of possible virtual addresses. So that's just 2 to the number of bits that we actually use in the virtual address. And I guess maybe I should emphasize that possibly a subset, possibly pointers have more bits than the virtual addresses. That's probably what you're getting at there. But the virtual addresses is the part we actually use for the lookup. Other questions? Not. Okay, so then about splitting addresses into pieces for cache lookups. So caches usually only deal with physical addresses. So we've already, meaning we've already done all the page table stuff. And we're going to divide our addresses into a tag, index, and offset. So the index is which row, which set, sort of row of the cache. And we'll always have a power of 2 number of rows, so 2 to the, of sets, 2 to the I. And then we'll have I index bits, which implies I index bits. And the offset is which byte of a block that might be stored in one of these sets. So, and we'll always have a power of 2 block size, 2 to the b, and that is going to imply b index bits. And the tag is everything left over, so we can tell where a value stored in a cache block came from. Question, yes? What you think I've done?
Because you said I implies I index bits, and then you say it implies B index bits.
Oh, okay. Oh, sorry. You said you meant B offset. Yes, I did. Sorry. There we go. Okay, yes. B offset this. Other questions, corrections, comments? Yes. Question is, which of these are stored in the cache? So let's go over that generally. So our cache is going to have sort of set a bunch of rows for each set. And in each set, we're going to have, you know, sort of a bunch of ways. So I'll draw two here. And we're going to have sort of, for each way, we're going to have a valid bit, a tag, and the actual data. And potentially sort of info for the write policy or LRU. And also potentially separate from the each way info for LRU, depending on, write policy or replacement. I guess I'll just say for the write policy, and we'll also potentially separately have info for our replacement policy. And that will be the contents of each. And this is the stuff here. So, and we'll just repeat that. But this here, this is what's actually stored. We'll have those repeated. So but we'll have that for every set. And the replacement info is info for replacement. So place info is, you know, info to implement replacement policy, and if needed, info for write policy is info to implement write policies if needed, and that's going to depend on what those policies are. But that's what's stored in the cache. So the set indices are not stored in the cache, and our index bits are not stored in the cache, but the tags are. And they have to be stored because when we get to a set, we need to know, is the thing that the data I find actually for the address I care about? Some other address with the same index. Because if it had the same index, it would also could also be stored there, depending on what happened. Okay, so questions on the, yes. We're going to talk about that next. Questions on before write policy stuff. How do I know which way to go into? That depends on, well, if one of them's empty, I go to that one. Otherwise, it depends on the replacement policy. Okay, so write policies. So we have two decisions. So if I look up something in the cache for a write and it's a miss, what do I do? Do I, A, add it to the cache? This is called write allocate. Or B, don't. This is called write no allocate. And if I modify something in the cache for a write, what do I do for the next level? Do I write it immediately? This is called write through. Write it there immediately, or do I write it there when I evict it? This is called write back, and for write back, we need to track track a dirty bit to remember that we have something to write, you know, sort of bad alternative that we're avoiding is we could always write everything that's evicted just in case, but that would be very slow because we are going to evict a lot of things that haven't actually changed. We don't want to waste our time sending writes of things that haven't changed. That's on write policies. I should go through these quickly because of time constraints. Okay, so cryptography, when to use public or private keys. So private keys are the ones you shouldn't share. They're the more powerful one. And for encryption, the private key lets you decrypt. And for signatures, the private key lets you sign. So they're the one that lets you do the thing that's the, you know, more sensitive operation. You know, so don't, you know, more dangerous for random people to be able to decrypt, and more dangerous for random people to be able to sign than. So decrypt, then encrypt, or sign, then verify. So that's how we can tell what they're used for. And something is probably wrong if you're sharing private keys widely. But we expect to share public keys widely. Questions on public private keys? So then the TLS handshake. So the TLS design is that the client and server agree on sort of temporary symmetric keys, and then, you know, and verify, the client verifies that it's talking to the right server, and the client and server communicate the rest of the time with those symmetric keys. And to do this, to agree on temporary symmetric keys, we use a key agreement protocol where, you know, client plus server generate sort of a secret value plus a key share for that value, and they combine their secret with the other's key share, other's public key share, I guess key share, which is public, to produce a common, shared value that others can't know, and use that value to make keys for symmetric encryption and message authentication codes. And to verify they're talking to the right server, the server signs its key share, you know, what the client used to make the symmetric, used to get symmetric keys, with a private key that corresponds to a public key the client will get from a trusted source. And how does the, you know, what trusted source? The server presents a certificate showing that some trusted third party, the certificate authority, attests, whether correctly or not, that this public key really comes from the server. Question?
For
question for step one, is it supposed to be asymmetric keys? No, it's supposed to be symmetric keys. So they use this key agreement protocol to get a shared single value that is going to be used for symmetric keys. But this key agreement protocol is being bootstrapped, is a basically something that uses asymmetric keys internally. And this step of verifying we're talking to the right server, that also uses asymmetric keys. And then the rest of the communication is done with symmetric keys, because symmetric keys are much, symmetric cryptography is much faster than asymmetric. I guess faster and more flexible. So we have this handshake process where we, use an asymmetric process to get symmetric keys and then verify we're talking to the right server, but then we use these symmetric keys because that's just so, so much faster than doing everything with asymmetric keys. And also, if we did it with asymmetric keys, we run into things like, I can only send like a kilobyte at a time. We usually don't have that problem with symmetric schemes. So questions on the handshake overview? Okay, so routers networking. So router is a machine connected to multiple networks that forwards data from one to another. And how does it do this? So typically it has a routing table which tells it what range of addresses should be sent to what network. And these are by addresses here equals network layer addresses. So internet on the internet, this equals IP addresses. Network layer addresses. The messages will also have a link layer address, which is typically MAC address, but that's only for the local, within each local network. And the messages will often also have a port number, but that's only for the sending receiving machine. So we have other types of addresses in the messages, but the network layer one is the one that matters, and that's going to be our IP addresses. In sort of the internet set of protocols and some other set of protocols, it might be some other type of address. And then the different protocols. So let's talk about, so we have our sort of layers. We had our sort of transport, which was sort of, we had TCP, which is streams of reliable bytes. That's built on top of, and UDP, which is datagrams of unreliable datagrams. I should just say not of bytes because that's built on top of IP, sort of sending messages between networks. If you remember, IP stands for Internet Protocol, and Internet is internetwork. That's where the name comes from. So it is going between networks. Sending messages between networks, which so includes routing. And then we have the link layer, which is like Wi-Fi, Ethernet, Bluetooth, which is for sending network messages within a local sort of network. So that gets all of these except a few. So then we have some special cases. So TLS is a sort of provides secure channels, typically on top of TCP. So it's a sort of application layer, because we have And DHS, DHCP sort of is a protocol for getting IP addresses on a local network when you don't already have one, you know, which has to do some special things because you don't have an IP address yet. Questions? Yeah.
So what's the difference between when you would use TCP and UDP?
So the question is, what's the difference between when you use TCP and UDP? So if I'm giving you advice on making actual applications, usually my advice would be use TCP, unless you have a good reason not to. TCP gives you reliable, so TCP makes things be a stream of bytes. You don't have to worry about how big a message can I send. You can just send any number of bytes and it will handle splitting it up for you and putting it back together. And it will handle making sure it's sent reliably. If you don't care about that stuff, you might use UDP. And you might prefer UDP over TCP in cases where you would like to handle cases like, what if I lose a message differently than try to get the message back by sending it again. But that's, you know, but I say, if I'm giving practical advice, I'd say, you know, don't worry about it. See if TCP is good enough, but maybe it's not for some cases. Like maybe if you're streaming video, you really don't want to be wasting time resending video you're not showing anymore. And TCP might make that a little difficult. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, then forwarding installing. So forwarding is in a, you know, so when we can't read the write value from a register because it's not computed yet in a sort of pipelined or out of order processor, not written yet, pipelined or similar processor, but the value is computed, we can send it, we can add a new wire to the processor to forward the value to where it's needed. So that's what forwarding is that we're just observing that, oh, can't read it yet, but I can send it where it's needed because it is computed in time. So need, the value is computed before we actually need it. We actually need it, just need to add some path to send it, since it's not going to be sent via the register file, which is what we normally use. Register file, yeah, because we write too late and or read too early. Because usually there's a gap between when we actually read from the register file and when we use it, and the gap between when we compute the value and when we write it. And stalling is when we don't have a value ready, we might need to wait. We can delay an instruction. We can delay the delay processing instructions until it's ready. So this is generally in our pipelined processor. You know, usually, most commonly, sort of repeat the decode stage until we can forward a value that is not written, not computed yet. You know, yet typically from the memory stage. And finally, in Spectre Meltdown, what bits are exposed through the side channel? So if we're using the cache prime and probe technique, we learn what cache set was evicted, and how does the cache choose what set is evicted, using the index bits of the physical address that was accessed. So that's the information we learned. Those index bits, we have to figure out where they are for the cache, of the whatever physical address we ended up accessing, we get to learn that with the prime per picnic. There's other side channels we didn't talk about, which might give us different sets of bits, but with the one we showed, those are we got those index bits. Some questions? Well, since I'm just out of time, so we should have office hours in the coming days, less than usual, but hopefully the calendar's up to date because I reminded my TAs to do that. And yes, and as was mentioned in the email, assignment and quiz are due tomorrow. And see you at the final, which is here.